Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 122. Shrink Wrap Radio Live number 1, December 3rd, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional. Surprise, everyone! Here's an unexpected bonus show for you. As you know, I've been planning to do a live call-in show using Blog Talk Radio. So my friend Jerry Trumbull and I decided to do a trial run today, December 2nd, in preparation for the one that we've announced for this coming Sunday, December 9th. Well, we recorded today's trial run, and I thought I'd put it out here in the feed to share with you all. We didn't get any call-ins, but we did have 10 listeners drop by, according to the Blog Talk stats. I'll give you more info about joining us for next Sunday's show, and I hope you will, after you listen to today's show. The time flew by for Jerry and me, and I think we had a very good, unscripted interaction that you'll enjoy. And because this is a recording of a recording, the sound isn't great, but it is intelligible. I've skipped over most of the part where we introduce ourselves. Let's jump in on the tail end of that, where Jerry is finishing up the description of Shrink Wrap Radio. Take it away, Jerry.
I think anything that has the word psychology in it is in your purview. I've been amazed at the variety. In fact, that's what I love about the show. I have my own particular area of interest in psychology, but listening to your, 120 shows now?
Yeah, 121 actually just went up.
121. I'm blown away by the new ideas that I hear from your guests, things that I wouldn't have normally even considered, and often it inspires me to do some additional research, you know, from an internet point of view, following up on things like lucid dreaming and other areas that I do have an interest in, and then, like I say, opening up new areas.
Well, that's great, and I get that feedback from listeners as well. I was just reading an article in my morning paper about iTunes University. There was a big story in there. You know, I don't know if you're aware of it, but quite a few, that might be too big a claim, but a number of leading universities are making certain lecture series by professors available through iTunes, and I was inspired by that. Well, first of all, the reason I bring it up now is the thought flitted through my mind, well, geez, maybe Shrink Wrap Radio should be part of iTunes University just because it is so educational.
Yeah.
However, since it's not being sponsored by a university or part of a university lecture series, that's probably unlikely, but it is, I think, fully as educational as some of the content that I hear there. I know you're interested in theoretical physics, so I was looking at, there is a lecture series there on theoretical physics, and so I just tapped into it a little bit this morning to see, actually it's a video one, so the guy was up at the blackboard, or the whiteboard in this case, and I wanted to see, how much math do you need to know?
Right, that's always the question, isn't it?
Yeah, right, in order to follow this thing. So, and indeed, the first thing, he went up there and he started writing an equation, and then he started talking about the differential equation.
Yes. And calculus.
Yeah, you know, and I took calculus actually late in life.
Yes.
not so long ago, but you know what? I couldn't remember what the heck it was.
Yeah, right.
So I dropped out of that one. Then I looked at one on existentialism, where there is this professor who's very highly rated at Cal Berkeley, a philosopher, and so I tuned in a little bit on a couple of his just to kind of pick up on the flavor of it.
Yeah, that's really an interesting idea. I think it was a couple of years ago, MIT announced that they were putting all of their coursework on the Internet for free.
Yeah.
And I was going like, wow, that's totally amazing, because, as you know, I have a somewhat jaded view of the academy in that it seems in some cases that basically you're buying a piece of paper and 4 years paying with 4 years of your time. And this idea means that you can now get the information and presumably the education for free. You still can't get the degree.
Exactly.
And to me, it makes it more obvious that the degree is just a receipt for probably what amounts to these days $60,000-$70,000 over a period of 4 years.
Yeah, it's not only a receipt, though, but it's also an e-ticket, you know, as in Disneyland. You get to go on the good rides if you have the ticket.
That's about it, yeah. But I think it's, I mean, this broadening of information, education, it's just fantastic to me. In fact, ever since 1980, when I first got into computers, I spend very few hours that I'm not on the computer. And people have criticized that and said, well, you need to get a life. And the other day I read an article about the online life of people. And I thought, well, yeah, that's more like what I do. Because when I wake up in the morning, I feel like, and I turn on my computer and I jump right on the Internet, start doing whatever it is that I have planned for the day, or not planned. I feel like I've stuck my head into the biggest library in the universe.
Exactly.
Where everything is available at just one or two clicks away. And I do indulge in, I guess, surfing is what you call it. I mean, I wander around, but I find the most amazing things when I do that.
Yeah, right. And, you know, this article that I was reading about iTunes University, they gave the example of a long-haul trucker who's been, you know, taking this complete course in philosophy and existentialism and also the course in quantum physics.
Wow.
You know, and to think of how ideal it is for this guy. He doesn't have an iPod, by the way. I know you are allergic to everything that starts with the letter I. And he's using some other setup, and he has it set up in the cab of his truck so that it's playing through a stereo loudspeaker system. And so here's this guy, you know, who's spending hours and hours on the road, and he's getting an education from top scholars in the land.
Wow, that is truly amazing. Yeah, you got to love it. It's kind of like the democratization, I guess, of information, of education, because in the past it's always been basically a wealthy person's endeavor, and then, of course, as the university system began to open up community colleges, two-year programs, and so on. It became more democratic with a small D. And now it's like you can learn anything you want. And when I see the kids, I mean, I've been blown away by six-year-olds whipping around on the Internet looking up stuff and getting more and more information. I think it's going to lead to a generation of well-informed, maybe not geniuses, but it'll certainly be a big step forward from what it has been in the past, where you had to go to a library, check out a book. Not an impossible thing to do, but nonetheless, it was kind of some planning involved in that. And now it's just, oh, I think I want to find out. Go to Google, boom, 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 boom. There you go. You got a whole list of resources to check out.
And the amazing thing, too, now, is that if you have an iPhone or you have a laptop computer and a Wi-Fi connection, it's portable. You could be, you know, most any place in the world or the country, and you have access to this vast storehouse of human information, knowledge, history, etc. It's funny. Sometimes I reflect that we live in the future. We live in the scientific future that, you know, that we read about and that would have been science fiction when we were kids, and it would have been kind of mind-blowing science fiction. And it's amazing how the human mind so quickly adapts to things that we just become totally blasé, you know, like, well, duh.
Yeah. In fact, interestingly enough, I saw recently an article about the growth of internet users, which you would expect, well, of course, it's the young people, but no, the fastest growing segment is the older people, 55 and up.
That's interesting, and marketers don't seem to tumble onto that. You know, I wear another hat in which I'm a marketing research consultant, and often the people who hire me, they're still wanting to pitch everything to the younger crowd, and they don't seem cognizant of what you just said, that so many of the people who are online, in fact, are in an older demographic.
Yeah, they don't get it yet, but I think they will soon enough. Let's face it, although the young have a lot of money for discretionary spending, the old people have a lot more.
Hey, we have more. Yes, we do.
Really? I'm sure you'll see a shift. Just to give you an example, I get these questionnaires to fill out, and I would get paid $5 or $10 for filling out the questionnaire. And I learned of that link through you and your show, and you warned me that I would probably find that I wouldn't qualify for some of these questionnaires because of my age. And indeed, that is almost always true. I'm 67. Wow. I put in my real age, and after two or three more questions, then I'm told I don't qualify, so I don't get to take the quiz. So it seems they haven't learned the lesson yet, but I'm guessing they've got their ear to the ground, and they will figure this out soon.
Yeah. Well, you know, while we're on this topic of the internet and how it's changing us and this all of the electronics and so on, I think it was in Scientific American Mind. I just got the latest issue, and I think I saw a note in there that somebody's done some research with women and video games. They exposed a group of women to a certain sort of action-oriented video game. I think it was some kind of World War II type game. I don't remember the exact name of it. But, you know, typically women score poorly on tests that have to do with spatial relationships, that is, in comparison to men. And they found that after 10 hours of experience in this video game, the women came up to score comparably with men in terms of some standardized test of spatial orientation.
That is really interesting. In fact, along the same line, I remember reading that surgeons these days who use these microscopic instruments, if they have a history of playing video games, they do a lot better in the surgery, or at least in the learning process of this microsurgery stuff. So it's interesting the study you just quoted, because I'm amazed it only takes 10 hours to get them up to speed.
Yeah, and of course, I don't think this study did a follow-up, you know, to see how long, either how far that new learning generalized or how long it persists. So, of course, there would need to be additional research to follow up on that. You know, while we're talking about things read in magazines and science and all of that, I want to share with you and any potential listeners. And by the way, you know, I think this will be archived, and I may just also repurpose it and send it out. So this will not go to waste.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So the current issue of the New Yorker magazine I want to alert you and everybody who might eventually hear this. The December 3rd, 2007 issue of The New Yorker has one of the most astounding articles I think I've ever read. It starts on page 64 in the section called Annals of Science, and it's titled Darwin's Surprise, and the subtitle, Why Are Evolutionary Biologists Bringing Back Extinct Deadly Viruses? That's certainly a good question, and
yeah.
Some of that, and some
what's
of that
the answer
is,
to that one?
Well, I don't know. It's pretty scary. It was like, hey, why are you even telling us this? You know, they even give a nod to the fact that terrorists could make use of this information. Okay, New Yorker, thanks for printing this then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, of course, there's always that positive potential upside that the reason they're doing it is because, you know, to kind of cut to the chase, is that there is the potential of developing vaccines against such viral diseases as AIDS and other viruses. But the thing that's fascinating me about this article, and I don't even fully grasp it and incorporate it yet, you know, because it is way out of my field of expertise, but it's in a popular magazine, so it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's certainly expressed in a way that a person like me can understand it, is the extent to which viruses, which are somewhere between life and not life,
right?
They're not alive in any sense that we would normally think of as life. But what I get from these articles, this article, is that the virus is able to, that it has a parasitic relationship such that it gets inside a cell, and then it takes over that cell, and it starts replicating itself like crazy.
Right.
And these viruses are millions of years old.
Right.
Millions of years old. They're among the oldest things on the planet.
Right.
And the degree to which they have shaped human evolution, this is what the news is to me, that they can get in there, these retroviruses, and they can mess with the DNA and mess with things that are heritable. So here's yet another level at which we're not as much in control of what we think and who we are and our personalities, etc., as maybe we imagine. Maybe these little buggers are in charge.
It may well be. In fact, along the same lines, I can't remember the details. But I blogged about this at one point, but I'd have to look it up. But most cats carry a certain virus, and what they found was that the virus can jump from cats to rats, and they also found that when it's in the rats, it makes them like cats. So, in other words, it kind of modifies their behavior so they lose some of their fear of cats, ooh. Therefore making them more susceptible to be eaten by cats.
Yeah.
And the theory was that the same virus can affect people. And, of course, you do have some people who are staunch cat lovers. And actually, I told this story to my daughter and my granddaughter because they have cats, and they were, oh, no, that's not it. But it's common knowledge that pregnant women should not change litter boxes. And that's the reason, because of this virus that's carried by cats. It's I guess during the first trimester or something like that, women are susceptible to it, and it can have an effect on the unborn child. So, yeah, it's interesting to think that these little machines, these little viruses, are grinding away at something that we're not even aware of, and maybe, oh, look at that cute little kitty.
Yeah, right. Well, in a different article, I read something about people who are chocolate lovers or, quotes, addicted to chocolate. In fact, that addiction, and I think I might be one of those people, is driven by some kind of microbial activity in their gut, that some people have certain microbes in their gut.
I read that same article, and I truly believe, in fact, if where have I seen this, I don't know, but we are a collection of bacteria, viruses, and then, of course, our own cells, but we are totally inhabited by these other creatures. And as you point out, we like to think that we're in charge. In fact, I see more and more evidence every day that we're not in charge. In fact, I think our conscious mind, if you want to use that term, is basically just this little homunculus sitting on the top, and the rest of it's all running off by itself, sort of half out of control, with the immune system, for example, being the most critical part. And do we, you know, if we don't get enough sleep, for example, our immune system goes down, other organisms get to attack us and so on. And it's almost like we're trying to marshal the forces of this large army, our own cells, but we really don't have the ability to do it.
Yeah, and the interesting thing to me is that Freud, you know, made that assertion early on that only about 5% of who we think we are is, you know, I guess his assertion was that 95% of what we do is for unconscious reasons. And so he might not have, obviously he didn't have access to everything that we know now about what's going on underneath the surface. But, you know, he was on the right track with the idea that, there's a lot going on beneath the surface that we're not aware of that's directing our behavior.
Totally. I think it's totally correct. In fact, here's a question for you, Dr. Dave. Do you think if humans did not have language, that we would have consciousness? Now, I know that's a big one. That's a big one to throw at you off the cuff here. But
Dr. Dave always gets nervous when people start off questions with, "Now tell me, Dr. Dave." Dr. Dave puts on his armor at that point.
I was just reflecting on this idea that consciousness is this voice in our head talking simultaneously with everything else, kind of monitoring who we are, what we do, how we interact, and then I was wondering, this question has come up a lot. Do lower organisms, as we call them, do they have consciousness? And clearly they do, self-awareness, however you want to define it. Anyone who's owned a dog can look at their dog and tell that their dog is thinking certain things. And do they have self-awareness? I don't know. I'm just wondering how much consciousness depends upon language.
Right. Well, that's a great question, and it just so happens that I was, and this may be a slightly tangential answer, but I was listening to a podcast interview just yesterday as I was driving down to San Francisco, and it was the Australian podcast series that I really love, and anybody who's interested in psychology should know about this one, though they shouldn't listen to it to the exclusion of Shrink Wrap Radio. It's called All in the Mind, comes out of Australia, and the interviewer was interviewing Steven Pinker, who is a psychologist at Harvard University, and he's written several books, and he's got one that's just come out that's all about language and thought.
Mm-hmm.
And he was making the point that thought does exist independent of language.
Okay.
And to me, that really registered. As a matter of fact, I commented on that. I kind of stopped it and commented to my wife, who was also in the car, because I remember when I was an undergraduate at the University of Pennsylvania, where you and I first met long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember a composition teacher saying to some student probably raised what is a common undergraduate complaint when they get marked down on an essay, "Yeah, well, I knew what I was trying to say, I just didn't I didn't express it that well, but I really do understand it in some complexity. And the standard professorial rejoinder is, if you can't say it, then you don't really know it.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, that's the version. But evidently, psychology has now come to a place that kind of can refute that idea, that in fact it's possible to know things that you can't articulate very well. And certainly we see that in certain kinds of learning disabilities or aphasia, where we know people maybe have, that there's certain kinds of knowledge that's locked up in the brain, but that people aren't able to express. That maybe bears a little bit on the question that you asked.
I think so. In fact, you can imagine an emotional feeling without words when you were saying that people can experience things and not be able to describe them. That, yeah, I mean, close your eyes and reach out and feel a surface, and then how would you communicate that feeling, that sensation, in words? You could stumble around and probably say, well, it feels smooth, but that's just a label you're sticking on it. You're not really describing the feeling, the sensation.
Yeah.
So I can imagine that dogs, for example, are having all kinds of feelings, sensations. They're also having emotions, and they just don't have the layer of words, or maybe their language of barking gives them some mechanism to communicate. I always am drawn to the conclusion that the biggest mistake that humans have consistently made, and it goes way back in history, is to consider themselves the center of the universe, or the highest on the phylogenetic scale, or whatever. We're always making the assumption that this little guy inside of us, or this little girl inside of us, is really the king of the universe, and everything centers around us. I had a discussion about religion recently, and one of my pet peeves, although I don't think people should have peeves as pets.
Right.
One of my pet peeves is the idea that a lot of religious people have, that somehow they are in contact with God. They get messages to and from God. Their life is God-driven. And I'm going like, who do you think you are? God has selected you from all the little piles of cells in the universe, and he's just, you know, checking you out and going to help your football team win? I don't think so.
Well, you know, this observation, my mind immediately branches out in several different directions. One is the animal thread that I want to stay with. And then before we got onto the show here, you had mentioned something about alien abduction, and that kind of relates to the God idea. So I want to go to that next. But before we do that, touching on the animal thing, again, in the current issue of Scientific American Mind, which I think is a great magazine, and I wish they would sponsor my show. I'm still trying to talk them into that, because I'm sure I could sign up a lot of subscribers for them. I'm giving them a free plug right now.
I'm writing it down right now.
Okay. There is a nice little sort of column piece here about Alex, the African gray parrot, the famous the famous Alex, who evidently died recently. Died 20 years before he was expected to die, because he caught an arterial disease which took away his little life.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a controversial bird, but most psychologists were, all but the most sort of hard-headed ones, were persuaded that, in fact, he had linguistic and thinking skills, because he was able to... Oh, we have a guest here. How wonderful. I see guest number 175. It says, sorry, I'm late. And let's see, there's a way. Do you have a chat screen open, Gary, where you're able... here's where I can type. So I'm just going to type welcome. So glad you found us. Are you a regular shrink wrap listener, I'll ask?
Okay. I'm not seeing this.
I'm not seeing it.
Is this on the Blog Talk site?
Yes. And, it's Anna the Man.
Oh, good. Good.
In Israel. And so Anna is a regular listener. And so I'm so glad that you've joined us. And I want to finish this thought that I was just into with Jerry here, but it's wonderful to know that at least one person is listening, and all the way in Israel. How wonderful. Here I am in the San Francisco Bay Area. Jerry is in Colorado in the Denver area.
Yes, and I'm familiar with Anna the Man through your website and the comments he's made in the comments section. So I kind of feel a connection with him.
Just
through Shrink Wrap Radio.
Yeah, definitely. And he reviews the Shrink Wrap Radio episodes pretty regularly on a website that he's devoted to reviews. And he's also a real smart guy. He has a PhD. So we have to be careful.
Are we going to be able to hear him talk, or is he just, is it text?
Right now it's text, but Anna, I'm under the impression that there is a button that you can click on somewhere on the site. He types thanks. I don't know why you can't see this chat, Gary. You should be able to see it.
I'm moving around in the site trying to find it.
Yeah, somewhere there's a place where you should be able to get on and see the chat.
Okay.
And he says he's going to have to drop off for a moment.
Okay.
So maybe he'll be back with us. But at any rate, I'm going to get back to the story of Alex, the African gray parrot, because this parrot had a huge vocabulary. I've forgotten just how big it was, and they don't say that here. But, for example, they say that he was able to think in ways that seemed really inventive. They said he could apply newly learned concepts to novel situations and often use his limited vocabulary in inventive ways. For instance, when presented with an apple for the first time, he reportedly called it a bannery, a portmanteau of the familiar labels banana and cherry.
Wow. I love it.
So he, you know, it would be hard to account for that simply in terms of, stimulus response conditioning or some other, non-linguistic model. Now, here's an interesting thing. And maybe you'll know something about this. They say to teach Alex to talk, psychologist Irene Pepperberg of Brandeis University refined the model rival technique. I hadn't heard of that technique before. Have you?
Well, interestingly enough, my daughter-in-law was and still is highly interested in parrots and has worked with Irene Pepperberg.
Oh, my goodness.
And I got a copy of her book, I'm looking up the name of it right now, regarding her body of work, the studies that she's done. And they, Janet asked me to read the book, and because she knew of my background in behavioral psychology. And so I read the book. I wanted to approach it with an open mind. And I was totally blown away. I was totally convinced by Pepperberg's work that she was getting to the heart of the matter with this model rival technique. It takes two trainers and the bird sitting together, and the parrot is kind of in the role of the student and tries to reproduce the behavior that they've just seen from the model.
Well, it reminds me of Bandura's work. Because there's a kind of vicarious learning going on, evidently, somebody is learning by seeing another learner learn.
Yes.
That's what I got from it. So this will reinforce what you just said. So going back to this, to teach Alex to talk, psychologist Irene Pepperberg of Brandeis University refined the model rival technique in which a third party demonstrates the correct response and competes for the teacher's attention. Sometimes this third party was another scientist in Pepperberg's lab. Sometimes it was Alex, who's the African parrot, helping to train a younger bird. Now, this is interesting. This role reversal is such a powerful learning tool that clinicians are now successfully using the technique with autistic children, extending Alex's scientific contribution far beyond the study of bird brains.
Wow, fantastic. In fact, it's interesting. Because of this relationship, as I mentioned, my daughter-in-law, Janet, having worked with Irene Pepperberg, she would often talk about the backstory, which was the rejection of Pepperberg's work because of the scientific community's inability to basically to grasp what was going on. And I know, for example, she worked at MIT for a while, and then she couldn't get grants to continue her work. And there was a time when she really had no base for conducting her research, because the typical psychologists, and there's probably no such thing, but they are not ready to listen to the fact, the facts of the matter. They're, you know, science is notorious for ignoring important new discoveries because they didn't fit with the old models, and just rejected out of hand that a bird brain, specifically a bird brain, could have language ability, because the brain is different, smaller, of course, and centers that we think of as being language centers are not there. And so on that basis and others, they just said, no, this is they're not really using language. The same arguments were used with the chimpanzee that recently passed away, who had a large vocabulary and could pass the tests of language use, not just parroting, interesting word, what they heard, but actually using them in the construction of new sentences. And I think that's what you were just talking about.
Wow. Hey, by the way, we have another listener here, Karen O. I'm not sure if she's a regular Shrink Wrap Radio listener or if she's just kind of stumbled upon this episode here. Let us know, Karen, in the chat room. Says she's from something called Sanity Squad. That's interesting. Wow. That must be another show. And unfortunately, she said she came early and then got involved with something else, and so evidently has missed a bunch of this. So yeah, it's too bad. Too often in the history of science, sort of at least initially major important discoveries such as this one that we've just been talking about kind of get shoved to the side, but then later, will be recognized.
Yeah. Yeah, I've forgotten the exact sequence, but there's this sequence that people talk about of rejection, and then I've forgotten all the stages, but eventually it gets to acceptance. And then it gets to claiming that they discovered it first.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, look, we've got maybe 5 more minutes left, and I know that alien abductions was something on your topic list. And
I recently met an interesting person, seemingly sane, and she had written a book, and she asked me if I wanted to read it. It's still in manuscript form, and I did. And the story was interesting, but a sidelight to the story was a person that she met who, from the beginning, she thought seemed sort of alien in his ways. There was something about his skin that she noticed. She said it looked like it had a saran wrap on it. And then she describes an experience where she was talking to him one time, and the iris of his eyes turned gold and filled in completely, filled the pupil in, and turned square. And then,
wow.
and, and she was like totally blown away while this was happening, and then it would slowly fade away. And this happened on a number of occasions. Then later, years and years later, she met another guy who asked her if she wanted to go up to a place near Sequoia National Park. And they went up there, and then he, after a couple hours of talking, he said, "You want to see where the spaceships land?" And, of course, she said, "Yeah, let's go." So they drove over to a place that she called a rift in the mountain where they could observe. And sure enough, a spaceship came and landed, and they were able to observe it. And I asked her to describe it, and it was pretty much round, hovering. You could hear an electronic or electric hum kind of a sound. And she didn't see any creatures. It had that spaceship had lights on it and everything. Pretty classic description of a spaceship. And then it went away. And I said, "Well, can we go back there?" And she said she didn't think she could find it again because she wasn't driving. But I got on Google Earth, Sequoia National Park, and kind of tooling around, and I found a place called Split Mountain. And I don't know if that's the place she described or not. But in discussing this with her, I was thinking, is this person just totally delusional? Are they actually seeing these things? Are they misinterpreting something? Or what's going on here? So I thought I would ask Dr. Dave.
Well, you know, that's a big question, and I don't have the ultimate answer to it. But there is a guy who recently passed away, and I'm going to block on his name. It's John something, and he was a psychiatrist at Harvard University. And he did a study of people who claimed to have been abducted by aliens. And they did not have any psychiatric disorders that he could detect. He decided that he would, you know, treat them with respect and hear out their stories, etc. And so as a kind of research study, he studied a bunch of these people. He's written a book, and I have a great video, which I'll have to send that video to you.
Okay.
Or tell you where you can get it.
Yeah.
And I think you'll find it very interesting, and maybe if you remind me on the next show, I'll look up the information so that I can provide it to anybody that hears this that wants to know his name.
Yeah.
I'm just blocking on it. But
his finding was that these people were normal.
They're not psychotic, and you know their stories are, you know, that yeah, their stories are pretty bizarre by normal standards, but they seem like otherwise normal people, and as you might imagine, these experiences really shook up their lives in some pretty big ways.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like we're going to run out of time here. We did have Karen O, who dropped in, who says she'll check us out next week, which would be wonderful.
Great.
And you mentioned your blog. Just very quickly, I wanted to give you a chance to put that blog.
Yeah, I have two of them. One's called astoundingnews.com, and that's for just my general thoughts. But most of my time these days is spent on denverdirect.tv, which is me running around with a video camera trying to keep track of the local politics here in Denver.
Okay, and we'll be on next week. I'm not sure if we're still on the air now or not, but we'll be on next week, same time, same place, and hope to have a lot of people checking in.
I just remember, it's all in your mind.
That's right. I forgot to say that.
I know.
It's all in your mind.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed this conversation between Jerry Trumbull and myself, and I'm doubly hoping you'll join us for the upcoming one on Sunday, July. And I'm doubly hoping you'll join us for the upcoming one on Sunday, December 9 at 10 in the morning, Pacific time. Now, you'll need to figure out what time that is in your part of the world. Just go to www.blogtalkradio.com/shrinkwrapradio. You'll not only be able to listen to the program live, but you will be able to participate in the discussion via the web chat window there on the site. You can also call in on the guest phone line to ask questions or to make comments. And that phone number is in New York, and it's 646-595-4286. Let's write it down right now, 646-595-4286. And if you use Skype or some other VoIP service, you should be able to call it for free or at very low cost. Now, previously, I had announced that you could use a talk button on the site and use your computer microphone to, quotes, call in. But evidently, that's an advertised feature that is not actually implemented yet. So once again, Jerry and I hope you'll be able to join us Sunday, December 9 at 10 a.m. Pacific at www.blogtalkradio.com/shrinkwrapradio. And remember that this podcast that you're listening to right now is brought to you by our sponsors, Podshow and GoDaddy. Shrink 3 will get you a discount on your next domain name upon checkout at GoDaddy.com.
This is Josh C. from San Jose. You're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Josh in San Jose, California. Let's take this opportunity to catch up on some back email from you listeners. Here's one from a while back that I meant to read and somehow overlooked. I think it might have been a response to my interview with Are You Serious, in which we touched upon the topic of psychedelics, but I'm not sure. It comes from Thea, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I have been a listener to your program almost since its inception, and I love it. I have listened to most of the programs and have backlogged others. I hope it's not too late to comment on the one about Timothy Leary, which I recently heard. I was a teenager in the 80s, but I always felt a nostalgia for the time of the hippies, the music, outlook on life, etc., and I live those days to some extent in my own way. I was very taken with books like Be Here Now by Baba Ram Dass and The Doors of Perception by Huxley. Though I did experiment with various drugs, including mushrooms, I was deterred from ever trying LSD because of a book I had read in which a young character had a bad trip and fried his brain. He went from reading Time magazine to reading comic books. As I grew older and investigated and lived various philosophies more deeply, I became disillusioned with the hippies because I believe they denied the dark side of human nature, denied that real love takes discipline, hard work, perseverance, and sacrifice. Hedonism and asceticism are mutually exclusive. I also came across cogent negativity about drugs. One of the instances you may be most interested in was, if memory serves me correctly, though I may be wrong, in a book by Marie-Louise Van Frans, where she recounts the dream of either one of her patients or even one of Jung's concerning drugs. A young man, a regular drug user, dreamed that he was floating in a boat on very placid water with lotus blooms on the water. He put his arm into the water, and when he pulled it up, his arm was gone. I think he lost both arms. The interpretation of the dream was that this man had continually sought bliss without the hard work of individuation, his unconscious being at odds with the bliss of his drug trips. Another thing I read that comes to mind about drugs was an interview with a participant from the hippie area, and he said that it was his impression that people who regularly take psychedelic drugs do not grow as people, but their personalities deteriorate. That came to mind because, if I remember correctly, one of the people he was referring to was Timothy Leary. Sorry to be so vague on details with these recollections. The last thing I want to share with you was that I remember hearing that Tim was dying of cancer and that he was going to commit suicide live online. I was horrified. I do believe life is sacred, and it is never in our hands to take. I must admit I was very relieved to hear that he died days before his plan was carried out. I do agree with you that the therapeutic possibilities of psychedelic drugs should be researched, but I would not volunteer to be one of the guinea pigs. Keep up the good work with your excellent program. Peace, Thea. Thea, thanks so much for those reflections of yours. And, you know, there definitely is a, I think there's both an upside and a downside to psychedelic drugs, and that more research indeed is called for. There's good evidence. There's research going on right now, and I hope to interview some people along these lines. There is research that, once again, is taking place in terms of the therapeutic possibilities for the use of psychedelics in treating certain conditions. I don't think that people's personalities inevitably deteriorate and go downhill. I can certainly think of plenty of exceptions to that. On the other hand, I did witness some that did. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. Let's move on. Next, we hear from longtime listener Susan, who writes, "Hi, David. You'll find my iTunes review, A Rave for Dr. Dave, by Susan Anonymous," I like both of those, "on iTunes. It's always fun to reflect on why we enjoy our favorite podcasts, and I enjoyed writing it. The interview of Dr. Tony Madrid blew me away. Two asthmatic mothers I've known immediately came to mind, and his profile almost eerily fit both of them. As a teenager, I babysat for three really lovable kids whose mom was very pleasant, but a bit uptight and perhaps OCD-ish. For instance, she'd boil her wooden clothespins before hanging up the laundry in the backyard. When I went to their home to watch the kids one evening, she told me that the eldest child, Linda, was asthmatic, and that I should check on her breathing while she slept and keep an eye on the thermostat to make sure the temperature stayed constant. While the mom breathlessly imparted these instructions, I noticed that Linda seemed a bit tense. When I put her and her siblings to bed, she told me her breathing didn't feel right. I did something which, in hindsight, might have been risky. I gave her a teaspoonful of honey and told her it would soothe her airways, making it easier to breathe. Within 10 minutes, she was sound asleep and breathing just fine. I don't know if Linda was separated from her mom at birth, and I wish I did, and I certainly have no expertise in psychology, but I would bet the mom perceiving her pregnancy and or Linda's birth is quite stressful or challenging. I would bet the mom perceived her pregnancy and or Linda's birth as quite stressful or challenging. Linda was her first child. I did a web search for a correlation between birth order and asthma, but didn't find anything to suggest this. Also, I find EMDR an exciting treatment modality, not only for its striking efficacy, but its potentially lower cost, too. Anxiously awaiting the next episode, Susan." Well, Susan, this is the next episode that you've been anxiously awaiting, and I hope it lived up to your expectations. And finally, just one more short one. Listener Patrick writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I never noticed your breathing to be a problem on any of the episodes I've listened to. Some of you might recall that I was distracted as I listened back to the show. I became kind of hyper aware of the sound of my breathing. I've since turned up a noise gate on this new device that I have, and you don't hear the breathing anymore, but now I wonder if it's cuts in and out a little in a jerky fashion. But I assume it doesn't, because I have not heard any complaints over the last two or three shows in which I've been using it. At any rate, Pat goes on to continue, "I loved the episode with Tony Madrid. I love the fact that he's willing to run on with something that works even when it seems magical. Regards, Pat." So with that, we'll wrap it up for today, and I'll remind you that you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, that you can leave voicemails for me on Skype, where my name is ShrinkPod, and that you can also use your microphone and the My Chingo button on the website. Or finally, you can leave voicemails on our phone at 206-337-0622. And once again, as I promised last time, and it didn't come true, our next show will take a guided tour of the Exploratorium, a world-class science museum here in San Francisco, with an exhibit area called The Mind, and our tour guide will be their staff neuropsychologist. I think you'll find it interesting. This is Dr. Dave remembering to say, it's all in your mind.